wanted to. Hanif Qureshi has courted a controversy from his Oscar-nominated My Beautiful Laundrette, pipped to that golden statue by Woody Allen's Hannah and Her Sisters. It was also nominated for a BAFTA in 1987. From that moment, he firmly established himself as an original voice. And for those of you who haven't seen it, why haven't you seen it? It features gay sex between a white boy and a Pakistani boy, drug dealers posing as mullahs, dodgy Pakistani businessmen. It was a distinctive voice, the voice that wrote this screenplay, and presented a very different immigrant narrative at the height of Margaret Thatcher's Britain. He exploded cultural stereotypes and seemed to be that seemed to be a kind of guiding principle for him. In 1990, he wrote his first novel, The Buddha of Suburbia. And that was about a mixed-race teenager who is desperate to escape his suburban life in South London. Again, plenty of sex in this book, lots of very fruity language. He's a writer that I grew up with. And because of that, I was particularly delighted to be asked to interview him. He wrote stories that I wanted to read. And I could go on to list everything else that he's written. I'm not going to, because you can find that out for yourself. I just wanted to mention those two things that were the two bits of writing that completely established his reputation at a very, very young age. He's now written his seventh novel, The Last Word, and there are lots of them in that room next door. I urge you, if you haven't read it, to buy one immediately after this conversation. And before I start asking him any questions at all, I'm hoping that he is going to read from it. It's essentially about, well, it's about lots of things, but it's essentially about the construction of a literary biography. Harry Johnson is 30, young, good-looking, and he's hired to write a biography about a writer called Mamoon Azam. He's a literary titan in his 70s, from the Indian subcontinent. And for those of you who are alert enough to know about these things, will recognise that many, many people have already said that this is redolent of Patrick French writing a biography of V.S. Naipaul. Hanif may disagree or agree. We'll talk about that later. Hanif, would you please read from your book?
Thank you, Rosie. This is a bit from the beginning. Harry knew that not a moment of the day passed when someone wasn't telling a story. And if his luck held for the rest of the day, Harry was about to be employed to tell a story about the man he was going to meet. Indeed, he'd been chosen to tell the whole story of this important man, the significant artist. But how, he wondered, with a rush of terror, did you begin to do that? And more importantly, was he capable of it? Harry gazed out of the train window at the genteel English countryside and almost wept. If the newspapers were right, Britain was a crowded island teeming with busy immigrants. Many were clinging to the sides, as on a little boat about to capsize. Meanwhile, everyone on board was so close together they were beginning to turn on one another like trapped animals, particularly since the financial crash. With the coming scarcity, no jobs, pensions, security, things would only deteriorate, and the safety that Harry had grown up with was gone. Not only that, it was said there were thousands of asylum seekers and refugees at the border, desperate to get into Britain. Some were packed in lorries, others hung from the undercarriages of trains. Many were tiptoeing across the channel on tightropes slung across the sea, while others were fired from cannons based in Boulogne. Children were strapped to the bodies of pigeons and sent across to Canterbury. Ghosts had it easy. But to Harry now, it seemed as if the government was injecting a strong shot of anxiety into the body politic, because all he could see was a green and unpleasant England. Neat fields, trimmed trees, bubbling streams, and the kind sky above it all. It didn't look as though you could get a curry for miles. Harry heard a whoosh, and beer spat at his face. He turned his head. Rob Devereux, sitting opposite Harry and cracking open another tin, was an editor at a respected and innovative publishing house. Not long ago, he'd approached Harry with the idea of commissioning him to write a biography of the distinguished immigrant writer, the Indian-born Mamoon Azam, a novelist and essayist Harry had admired since he was a teenage book fiend. Harry was immediately responsive and excited. After years of study and obedience, things were turning good for him, as his teachers had said they would, if he concentrated his thoughts, zipped his fly and his lip. This was his break, and he wanted to weep with relief. He deserved it, he reckoned. Not long before, in his late 20s, Harry had published a well-received biography of Nehru, containing much new material. And although the familiar story had now, in the modern manner, to be lightly spiced with interracial copulation, buggery, alcoholism, anorexia, the work was considered on the whole to be subtle and illuminating. And even Indians liked it. Now Harry was reviewing and teaching. Today, on a sunny Sunday afternoon, Harry and Rob were on the train to Taunton to visit Mamoon, at the house where the legendary writer had lived for most of his adult life. He shared it now with his new wife, Liana, a spirited Italian woman in her early 50s. Rob had no doubt that Mamoon would help Harry, since Mamoon had finally agreed that the book was a good, if not essential, idea. Liana was proving to be extravagant, if not more expensive and indeed more explosive than any woman Mamoon had experienced before. Rob said it was as if Gandhi had married Shirley Bassey and they'd gone to live in Ambridge. There was no doubt about it. If the book was a success, he would be set up for years. It would be his ticket to ride. But, said Rob, let's not get carried away. It'll be a fire walk. The old man will exasperate you with his stubbornness and taunting. His wife will definitely make you completely demented, and you might have to sleep with her. What? Why? It'll be worth it to get the story, said Rob, and you're a pig with a keen snout when it comes to sniffing out the truffle of a woman. Let it be her. He said that clever old sly fox Mamoon might seem dull and dead to you, and indeed dead to everyone, including his own family. He comes on like someone who's never knowingly given pleasure to a woman. But he's stolen a lot of enjoyment. He's been a dirty bastard, a thug, possibly a murderer. He had, said Harry. How common is this knowledge? His ex-mistress, said Rob, a Baconian torso on a plank, is bitter as cancer and spitting gobbets of hate to this day. She lives in America and she will fly at you like a radioactive bat. He drove his first wife over the edge, of course, I'm sure. He wrapped oranges in a towel and beat her blacker and bluer than a decayed Stilton. He did? Yes, said Rob. You've got to step up, dude. Mamoon is ready for you. I primed him. Primed him, said Harry. Primed him in what sense? He's been told, said Rob, been told by all of us, that you know your stuff, that you stay up for nights without sleep reading the densest material, Hegel, Derrida, Gibbon. You said that, Gibbon? I had no choice but to advertise you, Harry, said Rob. But you've told him, you said I understand Hegel. You're not an easy sell, said Rob. With you, I'm starting from zero here. Suppose he asks me about Hegel. Well, you'll have to give him an overview of the dialectic. I can't, Rob, said Harry. I can't give him an overview of the dialectic. What about my first book? Didn't he read it? It had its longueurs, said Rob. Even your mother would agree. The old man struggled to get through the introduction, had to lie down for a week to clean his palate. So, man, he said, you've got to reach the new level, or you'll be so fucked. You'll have to get work as a journalist. Or even worse, an academic. Or even worse than that. Worse? What could be worse than being an academic? Rob paused and glanced out of the window before delivering the news. He said, you'll have to teach creative writing. Please, no, said Harry. Please, no, I'm not qualified. Even better, said Rob, no one's qualified. Imagine being lost forever in a dark forest of uncompleted first novels that require your total attention. The horror, he said. I can see that that has focused your mind. Thank you.
Let's start then by talking about why you wanted to write a story which is about literary biography. Why did that appeal?
I was writing, I had a good idea for something this morning I wanted to write, and I was thinking, and it was two people and a man visiting his ex-wife, and I thought, what I like about the story, and what I like, to answer your question about what I liked about the idea of this novel, was the setup. So that when you have an idea, you think, well, this is going to happen. One person's going to visit somebody else, and then something's going to happen between them. And what's really great is I don't know what's going to happen between them when I start to write, but I know it's a good situation. Somebody walks through the door with a gun, you know that it's a dramatic situation. So with this story, The Last Word, I like the idea of writing about an Indian writer, because I come from a family of Indian writers. I like the idea of writing about a young man, I guess, because I was a young man once. Women, drugs, lots of conversation, lots of arguments. So it just seemed like a good structure. I know that I've got an idea for something. I need a structure in order to sort of organise it, and then I can find out what I want to say. The Weekend was like that. It's a film I wrote recently, directed by Roger Michel. And it starts on, they get on the train, they go to Paris, and at the end they come home again. And so it had a good structure. And in between they argue. Can't say fairer than that for entertainment, can you?
There's been so much written already about the extent to which this book mirrors the story of Patrick French writing about V.S. Naipaul. This is right at the beginning of the interview, so let's just get it out the way. Tell us whether you were thinking about that, because there are so many. I mean, Mamoun is very much like Servidia. He even looks like him in your descriptions of him. It's kind of deep-set eyes, very dark, goatee beard, he's a literary titan, etc., etc. So just set the record straight here in Asia House. Is that what you were thinking?
I remember someone saying to me, Patrick French is going to be upset about this. I said, why? He has a really good time in the book. Everyone finds him very attractive and lots of people sleep with him. Why would he complain about that? Why would he speak to his lawyers about that? Hardly seems to me to be a libel. It seems to me it's rather done him rather a favour, though I don't know him. I was excited. My stuff's always got grumpy Indian old men in it. If you look at My Beautiful Laundry or The Borough of Suburbia, any of my stuff, it's my, grumpy Indian old men are my Mona Lisa. I come from a big Muslim family with a lot of, my dad had 10 brothers. So I'm used to all those boys and all that smoking and drinking and showing off and shouting and fighting. So a character like Mamoun and the men in the Buddha or whatever are very familiar to me. So it wasn't as though I suddenly woke up one day and said I should write a story or a picture of a particular writer. It was just that the characters in my stories have got older and older. That's all, and they finally ended up in their 80s.
It's interesting hearing you say that you wanted to write about, an older writer or a writer and then a younger man because you used to be a young man, because you could argue that this novel is about different parts of your literary self. Just as much as it might be about anything else that somebody might want to impose on it. Did you, when you'd finished writing it, think, yes, this is as much about what I think about the journey of a writer, what it means to write, the importance of writing, why that should have a place in our society? Because so many of the conversations between Harry and Mamoun are about the importance of words.
Well, why bother about books at all? Why have stories? And not only that, because the fatwa against Rushdie in 1989 had a big impact on me. I was writing away, and then one day there was the fatwa, and after that you had to think, well, why am I doing this? Why does it matter that we're writing novels? What should we be writing novels about? And what is it to write a novel, let's say, I don't know, in China? What would it be like to write one in Pakistan? What's it like to write one in Britain? Wherever. What is the meaning of these stories? What do they do for people? What have stories meant for me? How have they changed my life? What's the point of all this scribbling away? As my kids say to me, all you do is sit in that room and scribble away, don't you? And you think, all I do is sit in this room and scribble away. And why are we doing this? So this book is an attempt to write a comedy about why we tell stories and what the point of the whole damn thing is and why it matters. and why it matters about how we use language and what language means and how we can communicate seriously to one another. In a time, as everybody knows, there's a lot of media, there's a lot of chatter going on in the whole world all the time, but actually, can you say anything that really matters to somebody else and that will affect them, or hear something that will affect you? So it's really about communication and how that really matters.
After the fact, we're in 89, were there moments when you doubted completely whether you should pick up a pen or sit down at your computer and write?
No, it seemed much more important after that. When I'd been in Pakistan in the early 80s, so I was aware of what they call fundamentalism or radical religion, and my family in Pakistan were terrified by it. So I could see that it mattered. And it seemed to me, after the fatwa, and I spent some time in schools and colleges and at the mosques from which I was thrown out.
Why?
Talking,
what did you do? What did you say?
I was making notes. It was so great. I was making notes, and they said to me, they came over and they said, "You're a friend of Salman Rushdie's, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah." They said, "Go on, piss off, get out of here." I said, "Listen, pal, this is God's house. It's not up to you." They picked me up and they threw me out of the mosque, the Whitechapel Mosque. It's like being thrown out of a pub. Closing time. Oh, piss off.
Yeah. And this was research that you were doing for the Black Album, what became?
And My Son, the Fanatic.
Yeah.
I just wanted to speak to these kids because I was so shocked by what was going on. And my father obviously had come to England, as it were, in order to have a better time, to have more freedom, to get away from the constraint of his family and his background. So the idea that you'd come to Britain and want more constraint was such a puzzle to me. Was so fascinating and so interesting about what was going on with those kids. And I thought I would write about it. It seemed to me to be important. And that's what I'd always written about, really, what it was like to come out of the empire, come to Britain and try and live here.
In lots of ways, let's get back to the novel. We can talk about the your earlier writing later on. Just to get back to the novel. So what happens is that Harry embeds himself with this older writer. He goes and lives in his country house, and what transpires is, on one level, a kind of P.G. Woodhouse comedy, farcical scenarios of the way in which Harry interacts with the old writer, the way in which Harry interacts with the writer's wife. He invites his girlfriend Alice to come. Alice gives the older writer massages. There are a whole series of things that take place, and there is also this entire other bit of the character of the landscape where characters who work for Mamoon, who are very poor white English working class people who work for him. They're his servants, essentially.
It's a colonial novel, and it's set in Somerset. It's the other way around. Yes, except all the masters are brown and the servants are white. It's basically upstairs, downstairs, turned the other way.
Why did you choose to do that? Because there is, you know, in a way it connects to all the other things that you've written in the past, which is to look at the ordinariness of working class people's lives. And here you've chosen to, they're not centre stage, but they're a very important part of the story. Harry ends up sleeping with the daughter of the housekeeper and so on.
Don't tell everybody what happens in the book.
They're really
looking forward to it. They didn't know that was going to happen.
Yeah, but the enjoyment of any novel, as you and I know, is not necessarily discovering the plotline. It's the enjoyment of the language and the jokes and so on, and I'm not giving those away. So tell me why you wanted to do that. Why was it important to have this poor... Essentially, you write them as poor white trash. You know, one of the.
I come from poor white trash. I come from the suburbs. I am poor white trash in one. In one part of me, I come from the white working class or lower middle class suburbs. I grew up in the 1950s and 60s. You know, in that world. So I come from that world as well. And you can see that in my beautiful laundrette with the Skinner character played by Dan Day-Lewis, posh boy. And the other character played by Gordon Warnicke. So that is partly what I come out of as well. I mean, a book is a dream. You know, when you have a dream, you're really shocked by it. You think, who the hell is that in my dream? Why are they in my dream? But a book is a dream in which every bit of the dream is part of yourself in some disordered way, linked to your to the centre of your life, I guess. So it's only in there because it's all bits of me, but I don't know why. I can't answer, in a sense. The less you know when you're writing, the closer you are to being asleep when you're writing, not when you're reading. I would insist, but when you're writing, the better off you are.
Did you feel by the end of having written the book that you understood why you had chosen the path of becoming a writer?
That's a good question. I never doubted that I wasn't a writer. I'm more of a writer now than I've ever been before. I mean, in a sense, it compels me. And you can see that with artists as they get older. They get more and more obsessive about what they're doing. People always say to you, can't you take a day off? And you think, that's a day wasted. I'm a writer because I have an idea and I've got to write it down. I really want to do that. I want to do it more than I want to do anything else. It seems more important to me than doing anything else. And that's why people like the idea of being artists, because in a sense, you never think, what am I going to do today? We never have that problem. We always know what we're going to do. It's really dull, but that's what we're going to do.
But it's
great being an artist. You have no choice whatsoever over your life.
You talk about it being dull, but I want to ask you a little bit about the reaction of your sons, you know, them saying to you, oh, will you just go off and you're just scribbling away. Does it matter to you that you haven't made that connection with them? Because so much of your writing is to do with your relationship with your father. Your grandfather makes an appearance in the character of Mamoon, it could be argued. You know, there's so much of a connection, and your life changed completely when you became a father. So tell me, to what extent, if at all, it matters that your sons see it just as scribbling?
One of my sons, yes, they find it rather pitiful. He came into the room, my study, the other day, and he looked around in a rather sad way, and he said, this is your life, isn't it, Dad? He said, in here, in this room, this is it, isn't it, for you? And he could see this man trapped in this pile of books, you know, scribbling away. And I said, yeah, this is how I pay for your shoes, mate. So, if I were you, I'd be grateful. Well, it's a mystery, isn't it? Because it's such a banal act. A man goes into a room with a pen, but then he becomes a writer and he connects to all these other people.
The reason I ask you the question, I should probably tell you the motivation for it, because you're seen very much as an emblematic writer for a generation of people. Like in the introduction, I said that you were a writer that I read, that I grew up with. You know, you're a little bit older than I am, but you're a writer that I read because you wrote about people who hadn't been written about before. So in that context, in a way, I suppose the question is to do with the extent to which your writing is relevant to the generation of your children in the way that it was relevant to my generation.
That's an interesting question. I don't know about that. That's a very good question. I don't know. I mean, my kids don't read at all. They've never read a novel anyway. None of them. I'm not joking, and they're at university. They watch, you know, long form, you know, 19th century novels, like American television. That's what they watch. The idea that they would sit down and read a novel. I don't know any men that read novels. Actually, I have to say, women read novels. I know that
not
I'm
not even you. You don't read novels.
No, I wouldn't read a novel. I wouldn't be caught dead. Wouldn't be caught dead reading a novel any more than you'd catch me wearing yellow.
Because
I don't read novels for personal reasons, because it interferes with my signal. You know what I want to do. I need to be in a certain state of mind, and if I read somebody else's book, sometimes you read something and it's so good and you think, this is hopeless. It's really pointless for me to go on. It's so beautiful. I could never write as well as this. And if you read anything bad, it's obviously a waste of time. So I can't get in the right place. But I read poetry. I don't need to read. I know what I'm doing now. I know what I'm doing, and I can sort of work out how to do it. I did all that before. I know what I'm doing now, and I want to do it completely individually in my own way. I want to find out what a novel is, or a story is, or an essay is, as I write it. And I want it to be new as I do it. I want to be as if no one's written a story before, or I've never written before. So I really want that sort of clarity, like having a conversation with somebody that is completely honest.
Is that completely different in your mind as a process to the way it was when you first started writing, which felt, certainly for people who read you, that you were completely located in the politics of the time, the socioeconomic situation of the time? Does it feel as though you're in a different... It's almost like you've transcended that, the kind of prosaic
Well, I was a realist. I wanted to be a realist. I wanted to be a realist because I wanted to write about my situation, which really bothered me because I grew up in a world where it was normal to be white. I grew up in a world where it was whiteness was the standard, as it were. You know, that was the thing. And if you weren't white, you were off the standard. And being white was normal. And anybody who wasn't white was either slightly retarded, or you were patronised, or you didn't quite fit in, or you were whatever. But that was the bar, being white. That was the standard. It was so odd to live in a world where that, you know, it's like being normal as opposed to being mad. You realise that the problem is the standard, the ideal, the notion of, you know, say the notion for people with certain bodies that that's the normal thing. What you've got to do is give up the standard, give up the idea of the normal, and then you're free. But I grew up when it was standard to be white, and if you weren't white, you were off the scale.
Can you remember when that you first became aware of that?
Well, you don't know you're black until you go to school. Then they tell you, and then you figure it out, and then you have to work out the whole history of colonialism backwards in your head. That really makes your head ache, I find. You don't know that you've got any colour or anything like that or a race until you go to school. You know, because you look in the mirror and it's you and there's your mum. And then your dad's standing behind. And then you're in and it's different. And then people begin to speak about you. And then you realise you exist in a, you know, in a network of other people's language. Then you've really got to figure out all of that. So...
But what happened, or what seemed to have happened to you, was that you just wanted to get away from that, but also write about it, because The Buddha of Suburbia is very much about somebody who wants to escape that suburban upbringing that you had had.
Well, I wanted to be in the 60s, because in the 60s, everybody was Jimi Hendrix, and it was a much more liberated place and time, and it was freer, and it wasn't so racist. As soon as I got to London, it stopped being racist for me because London was so cosmopolitan and mixed and it was a different world, you know. And you were away from the National Front and, you know, a lot of my friends were skinheads, you know, all of that stuff. So I got away from it. That's why I wanted to get away. But I wanted to write about it as a realist because so then you could see what was going on. I didn't want to write it symbolically like, say, someone like Kafka. I wanted it to be like he was wearing that and they listened to that and they did that and that so that people knew. It was a sort of record. And also I realised that I was very, very lucky because nobody had written from that position in England before. It was just luck, it was me. Bad luck for the public, but good for me. And I had a subject, which was the way in which Britain was conducting a huge experiment in terms of race. And it completely changed from a monocultural to a multicultural society that we now live in without anybody deciding this. And it was an incredible revolution that I lived through by mistake. And I wanted to write about that, and I still want to write about it, and it still interests me. It's a great subject, dramatic subject, and you're lucky as a writer if you've got a subject. So I wrote as a realist in order to get that down, as it were. That's why.
The relationship between... I'm just going to pursue this a bit because, you know, you and I have talked before and what interests me is that the ghost of your father is in so much of your writing and you tackle it head on in the non-fiction. Because he wanted to be a writer and he wasn't successful.
Well, and my mother and the white background that my mother comes from as well. The white, lower, middle-class background, I guess, that she comes from, that she still lives in, her friend, her world, and that world of South London too, all of that. But I was interested in it because it was representative, that my dad came from India to England to make a life, and then suddenly he looked at me and he said to me, "You don't belong anywhere, do you?" God, he was really shocked, as though it just occurred to him. You know? And I thought, God, no, maybe you're right, I don't. And then you really begin to think about what belonging is and what the problem with you is and the whole thing. So, and it's a very disturbing psychological difficulty, and it's also, you know, a problem of the world that you're living in that sees you as an issue, you might say. So it was that conjunction of things that made me want to write.
But not just write, you also... were very funny, and I want to ask you, because this book is very funny. There are just moments where it's impossible not to laugh heartily and not just chuckling and smiling and thinking, that's dry and amusing. They're very, very funny lines in it. And I want to ask you a little bit about that process, the idea of wanting to be amusing in a book. Do you see yourself as part of an English tradition when it comes to writing a comic novel?
No, it's a world tradition. All the best writers are funny. Any fucker can be unhappy. You know, it's being... You know, Beckett is a very funny writer.
Yeah, very funny.
Dostoevsky actually is a funny writer. Gogol, all the Russian writers I read as a kid, they're funny writers. And obviously the British and Irish tradition, you know, Oscar Wilde, etc., etc. There's something very subversive about a joke. You know, if you can make a joke at the teacher, you can really undermine the teacher's authority. So I always thought there's something very rebellious about humour that cut through the relations of authority, I guess. And, you know, as Stephen Frears says, we're in show business. You know, it's showbiz, it's entertainment. If people want to read one of your books, you've got to give them a good time.
It's really
important, I would tell, insofar as I still have a job as a creative writing teacher, I'd pass that on to my students.
Do you still do that?
Just about, yeah. I nearly got sacked after last time.
Yeah, didn't you say something about... Tell me what you said about...
I'm not even
let's not talk about that. Okay, fine. You were very, very uncomplimentary.
The dean was up all night, let's say.
I want to ask you about this idea of being subversive and being entertaining, actually, because at the, you know, when you were very, very young, when you found success with My Beautiful Laundrette and then The Buddha of Suburbia, you'd done this really quite remarkable thing of being critically acclaimed as well as being very, very popular. And people talked about you as a rock star at that point. And, you know, you've mentioned, you know, wanting to be Jimi Hendrix and so on. I just wonder when you look back on your, you know, you're a CBE now, you're seen as, I guess, do people see you as part of the establishment? I'm not sure. Do you see yourself as part of the establishment or not?
I don't think there is an establishment. No, I'm much more rebellious now than I ever was before. I'm much more angry about the world than I was before. I'm much more anti-authoritarian than I was before.
Wistful about your...
But I like England, and I like Britain. There are lots of things about this country that I love, so I'm quite reactionary as well. What's the question?
The question was, I hadn't finished asking the question. I got sidetracked. So the question is, are you wistful about your younger self? Do you feel that you wish you were young again, but with the wisdom that you've acquired or the experience of the writer that you are now?
That's such a ridiculous question. I'm not even...
It's not a ridiculous question.
Honestly.
I think you should answer it.
It's a ridiculous question. I don't know what it means.
Are you jealous of young people? It's about competitiveness, and you're quite competitive. That's what it's about. That's what the question is about. Whether you feel that there is a place that you wish that you still are, this kind of punky rock star that you were in your, you know, in your late 20s, which is what your reputation has been built on.
Well, I think a lot about the past, particularly the 70s, 60s, 70s and 80s, and I'm pleased that it was so interesting, actually, that I was so involved in it, and that I'm interested in British post-war history. And I still want to work. Otherwise, I can't answer the question. I just can't make any sense of what you're saying whatsoever.
Okay.
I really can't.
Okay, that's fine. You're entitled to say that. Perhaps we should open it up to the floor and get people to ask better questions than I'm asking. we'll do that in 5 minutes or so. Let's go back to this novel.
Because I like your questions, apart from that one.
Okay. That's not bad, then. We've been talking for half an hour. Only one question was ridiculous. That's pretty good going. Oh, look, they're keen to get involved. Tell me, you say that you get up every day and you want to write. This feels to me like it's a book that feels as though you have come to some sort of peace with yourself about being a writer. I'm wondering what it is that makes you get up in the morning and think, I want to write about this now.
Yeah, well, I had that this morning. And I thought I would tell everybody how exciting it was. It's like falling in love or being infatuated by someone, and you think, I really want to find out about that person. I really want to find out whether that relationship's going to work out, but I can only find out by getting involved in it and doing it. It's really to do with the excitement of thinking, but of thinking for a purpose, which is not only to do with my own, you know, imagination, but to do with writing something that somebody else might be interested in, and too. You know, it's for them. It really connects you to the world. It gives me a purpose. You know, my dad had a job. He worked in the embassy, Pakistan embassy, which was really dull. And he was always going on about, oh, I wish I had a purpose. And I think I've got there's some reason for what I'm, even though the world is meaningless, there is some reason for me to want to do this. And it's a good thing to do. It's that, really. That's why I'd recommend being an artist.
Even though you have difficulty with teaching people how to write?
I don't have any difficulty teaching them how to write, nor do they have any. What I have difficulty with is the system, really. I got no beef with the students, and they have no beef with me. What I don't like is, I mean, universities are basically Tesco's with books. I mean, they're trying to, you know, it's a commercial system, whereas we're trying to make art, I think, in some way. And that's a different kind of thing, so the two things don't always go well together. But I think of the university as a sort of dating agency. It's where you get to meet people, the students, and then you can get along with them or not. But it's introduction service. The dean's going to go crazy. He's going to be on the defibrillator.
Chatham House rules, perhaps, in Asia House, I don't know. I am going to open up the questions to the floor, since I've been so thoroughly dissed by the last question.
No, you haven't. I'm sorry about that. I do apologise for that.
Fine. But that's fine.
It's too complicated.
Yeah, it's way too complicated. Hand's gone up straight away. Sarah, wait for a microphone.
You were talking earlier about British-Pakistani identity and, you know, writing in the realist form because you wanted to represent that. And I was just reflecting as you were talking that growing up British-Pakistani kind of 30, 40 years ago, it seemed like such a marginal identity, and all that you were saying about sort of whiteness being the standard was so true, and it seemed such a kind of obscure thing to be. And then about 15 years ago, British-Pakistani identity became incredibly central to British culture as a whole. And just for a normal person like me, that was a really surreal experience, because my whole sort of upbringing and childhood was about being obscure and this strange sort of Pakistani thing in Britain. And then suddenly everybody was obsessed with British Pakistanis and extremism and jihadism, and it was central. What is that like as a writer, if it's so surreal for us as your average person? As a writer who's speaking to that experience, what was that process like?
Well, I would say that I'm interested in writing about what you have to do is really write about characters, you know, particular individuals. You can't really write about trends or groups of people. So you have to find, if I'm going to write about, let's say, extreme religion, I had to do it with my son, the fanatic, say, as a relationship between basically a father and a son. And what happens between these two people. And there are scenes of them in restaurants and so on, just talking about it. So I don't think you can think about it in sociological terms. I think you have to really do it. You have to find the right point of view, where the camera should be, where you're looking at the story from. And you would do it through the characters. So I wouldn't think about it as this is a story about Pakistanis or how Pakistanis have, you know, are on television all the time or anything like that. I would think, I need to write about this person and that person and what happens to them and make it really specific. That's what I would do. Ready there?
You said something about being thrown out of a mosque when you were researching for the Black Album. And I was just wondering, that was many years ago in terms of doing research. Do you still go out there on the streets and do your research, or do you stay locked up in your room because you've had all this wealth of experience over the years that you pick up characters from your dreams? How much research do you do out on the streets?
I'm You live in the world. I mean, you try and avoid. I try and avoid having interesting experiences as much as I can. But they happen to you all the time. But they might be really banal. I mean, it may be a really banal story. Say, I don't know, a man goes around to see his ex-wife to have a conversation. But you could write a really dramatic story about that, a really moving story about these two people. So you wouldn't have to go looking for anything particularly dramatic. You could find the most banal, everyday story and make it really significant and moving and interesting, as with a poem or whatever. So I don't think you necessarily need to look for anything big to write about. So you may have a conversation with your kid in the kitchen. Actually, it might, and that's fantastic. I mean, in the end, you're writing about the most significant thing. Say, with Little Weekend, I was writing about a marriage. What's it like to be married to someone for a really long time, and then you wake up and you think, should I leave this person? Could I have more fun with somebody else? Should I just get rid of them now? And they look at you and they think, they're going to leave me. You know, and that's a great situation. That's really fascinating. So you don't need a lot to happen to you to have a story, because actually the stories are already in people's lives there. If you went around this room and you asked everybody to tell a story about their life, your hair would stand on end with the complexity and fascination of the stories. So I don't do any research. I just hang about and stuff sort of sticks to me.
There's a great example of that, actually. I wanted to bring it up, and I don't know whether you did any research about this. The short film that you wrote called Weddings and Beheadings.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a fantastic short film about a cameraman in Iraq who films weddings normally, but actually nobody's getting married anymore, so now he films beheadings. And that's what it says on his card. And I wondered about the research for that, because in a way, you probably didn't need to do that much research. You just needed that one starting point.
Well, it was during the time when they were showing beheadings, not on the news. They didn't show the whole thing, but occasionally you see a bloke holding up a head. And you thought, what about the person who's filming that? What are they doing? You know, so you find I thought, well, I can't write about the Iraq war. It's idiotic. You can't. It's too much. But maybe I can just think about some bloke whose job it is to film these beheadings. And I thought, that's a great story. That's where the camera should be in terms of that story. That's all. And he's dragged in, you know, and he has to do it, and he doesn't like doing it, and that becomes his work. So the story then becomes a metaphor for people get, you know, haplessly involved in wars, that's all. So it's just seeing something that's already there, but seeing it from the corner of your eye, noticing it, and then pinpointing it, and then you've got a metaphor. You know, that's how it works. Go and do that.
Two hands at the back.
Hello. It's 25 years since the Rushdie affair, which you mentioned, and I'm just wondering what your reading is of what you think, if anything, remains unresolved about that, both within the production of fiction, but also within possibly British publishing, and also within the British Muslim community as a readership. What is there anything that remains unresolved about?
There's a lot in that issue, but the issue is really not to do with, it's really to do with language. What can you say? If you open the newspapers at any time of the day or night, they're always about what you can say about people. Can Jeremy Clarkson say nigger? Are you allowed to say paki? Can Luis Suarez say to Evra that he's a negro? What can we say? What are we allowed to say? What could we hear? What could we bear to hear? So all these questions are really about language and about our values and the relation between values and language and respect and disrespect and insults, descriptions and so on. So I think I can't answer your question, but I would say that this issue about what can be said and what we can bear to hear and where the limits and boundaries are of language, I think we're thinking about, if you read the newspapers this morning, it was about whether Jeremy Clarkson can say nigger or not, you know, and what that means and who's insulted and everything, you know, about the BBC, about British society, about where we are and so on. So I think the legacy of Rushdie is that, that this discussion about language and its relation to values will is actually it's our ethics. But do you want to say something else? I'm talking about ethics, actually, the whole thing. Actually, it's not only about freedom of speech. It's about what the limit means, what the boundary means, about how we see the other person, what we believe the other person can bear, the relation between different groups.
But what about fiction is somehow exempt as a special form of writing? Is there something about writing a novel or under the category of fiction that puts these debates in a different light?
Yes, there is, because I don't think a novel is an insult. I mean, an insult, for instance, if I came up to you and slapped you across the face, it would be an attempt directly for me or you to traumatise the other person. Whereas it seems to me that to think seriously about, say, what a religion is, or what a political institution might be, or what another human being is in fiction, seems to me to be a very serious exploration of what we're doing in the world, actually. I would make a distinction between that and just insulting somebody. And I think the fiction, which is the serious exploration, is much more important than any other particular set of values, whether you're a Catholic or a Muslim or a Hindu or a Scientologist or a liberal. I would make that distinction, yes. That we have to have a place which is called the novel or long-form television or wherever where we can think seriously really about what our values are. And Satanic Verses is really a book about someone actually losing their religion, losing their values, and what happens to them when that happens. And actually, most of the stuff around the Satanic Verses really came from people who were also losing their religion, for whom Rushdie spoke. You know, he was the spokesman for people who had doubt, and the Muslims who hated him really hated their own doubt about what it was they believed, that they were, you know, really entering modernity and the struggle with modernity, whatever that means. Any more?
There was somebody whose hand was up right next to...
Hi. What comes to you easily, writing scripts or the books?
It's really, you just want a good idea. And I do, at the moment I'm doing an adaptation, I'm doing another script, I'm doing a story. It's really, it doesn't bother me in terms of the form, because it's all the same to me. I mean, it's storytelling as a movie, or storytelling as a short story. So I don't think of it like that. I think of it as being an artist who might do a drawing or might do an oil paint or whatever. So it doesn't. I don't think about that. I know some people, you know, when they're working on a novel, they wouldn't want to stop working on the novel and then write a short story. But it's good for me to stop and think and do something else. So it's all storytelling. Razia?
I've just got a couple of questions. What's your relationship with V.S. Naipaul? Are you friends with him? Do you like him?
Yeah, we get along perfectly.
You hang out with him?
Or? Well, I wouldn't.
I mean, you good friends? Or is it just like acquaintance?
We hang, let's say.
I mean, you'd pick up the phone and you know him.
We hang, that's okay. All I'm going to say.
The next question is...
We hang loose.
You obviously must make enough money from writing books, so why are you teaching on a creative writing course?
Don't even get me started on that subject. Never ask a writer about money, it's the only thing that they'll be... why do I teach creative writing?
Yeah.
I like the students, I really like the students. And it's really good for me to teach. It's really good for me to teach, because you never talk about writing to other writers. Writers only talk about money and their divorces. Whereas when you're with a student, the student will say to you, well, why do you think this doesn't work? And you think, well, why doesn't this work? Well, and then you think, well, if you put that bit over there and that bit over there and that over there, then you might have what we call a story. So you have to really think about what a story might be, and why a story might work, and why that might work, and rather than that might work, and so on. So it's very technical. You know, you're really deconstructing the engine of the car and looking at that bit and that bit and that bit. And I find that really fascinating in terms of writing. And I can't do it with my own writing because it's got to be instinctive. But I can try and do it with somebody else's. That's why I do it. And I do it because I think it's important. If you know something, if you know something, if you can, you know, play chess or tennis or whatever to teach somebody else, I think that's a good thing
to do.
Do
you learn from them?
I learn a lot about... Yeah, I learn a lot about what works and what doesn't work. What is a good idea and what is why that isn't such a good idea and stuff like that. And I can see... But also, because I can see, because I've done it all, so I can see how lost they are and how fucked they are by trying to write a novel that they'll never get through and will never be done. And it's so difficult to write a novel, actually. What a difficult form it is, and what a bastard it is, how long it takes. And you can see the hope in their little eyes shining.
Are you kind and patient?
I'm the reality man. I'm the man that helps you by telling you the truth. And that is a very difficult position for me to be in, and more difficult for them to feel the lash of the whip. But actually, you have to say, look, this is going to take you a lot of time, much more time than you think it's going to take. It's going to be much more work than you think it's going to be. But it might be really good if you can actually bother to bear the frustration of writing this book. It'll turn out to be decent, but it'll be much harder than you think. It seems to me that's a useful thing to say.
Was there anyone like that for you when you were starting out?
Yeah, tomorrow I'm meeting, yeah, all the time. Lots of people are really good people I've worked with over the years, from when I was a teenager until, in fact, tomorrow morning I'm working with Roger Michel, who directs my films at the moment. He gives me a right bollocking. Right bollocking. Horrifying.
Because
but it's really good.
Because he presents you with clarity, or he thinks you're... What is it that he gives you?
So that's a really good idea. Oh, God, but that other idea you had the other day, that was a terrible idea. My God, why does this shit come into your head, he'll say. And you'll say, I don't know, Roger, why it does. It just pops in. You know, and so we're really doing something important together. We're working together on something that really matters to both of us. It's really creative and quite painful. But it matters, you know, and it matters to me. That's a good thing.
We've got a few more minutes for more questions. It's gone up. One there and one there. Paul first.
Who got you into poetry?
Who what?
Who got you into poetry?
How do you know I like poetry?
You said
so.
Did I?
Yes. It's all been happening here. You don't even remember.
Oh, God. Yes, I do read. I read quite a lot of poetry, yes. Faber, a very good publishing house, and they send lots of stuff to me, and I actually read it. Because it's because of the language, it's pure language.
Who got you into it?
I got myself into it, thank you.
Seriously? Paradise Lost? Really?
Well, I grew up, my father used to read poetry to us, and he used to, you know, me and my sister, when we were kids, he used to read to us. And there were always books in the house, so reading was I read, you know, and I've got books, but my kids don't read at all, whereas my dad had all these books, and I would pick them up and read them. I'm really shocked by that in my children.
I blame the parents.
Yeah, I think you might be right about that. I should have insisted.
I ask because there's people who read and write poetry, there's people who read and write novels, but very, very few people cross over. So it does seem a bit weird.
I don't write poetry. I don't write it. I wouldn't know how to do it. No. I wouldn't have the faintest idea. I feel like one of my students, I feel really incompetent in terms of what the hell I'm doing. I don't know how to do it.
Thanks. Tomorrow, if your son said, I want to be a writer, how different do you think it is for a writer today in the UK finding their voice, having something to say, finding a reason to write and a passion for writing? And do you think the future of storytelling is not necessarily on the page in quite the same way in the novel?
The future, well, the present of storytelling is in television. I mean, everybody's watching Breaking Bad, everybody's watching Sopranos, everybody's watching House of Cards. Those long-form telly 19th century novels, they're wonderfully complex, really interesting, with lots of characters, social detail. You know, they're like, it's like Thackeray. So, and I hope my kids would be interested in doing something like that. I find that really fascinating. I'm too old to do it now, and it's too knackering for me to write at such a length. But I can see it's a fascinating thing to do, that actually stuff like Netflix and so on is really interesting for young people, and you can tell really big stories on a big canvas. I mean, the thing about a movie is, on the whole, it's 90 minutes, 2 hours, whatever, whereas this stuff is like, you know, 20 hours, 30 hours, whatever. It's a fantastic opportunity. I'd like to do something about, there's a director I'm quite interested in working with and helping them do something set in Britain from the 50s through to the present day, a big story like that. I think it's a really great opportunity. So it's not as though storytelling has, you know, suddenly died because of Twitter. That's absolutely not the case at all. It seems to me that, you know, and you go around people's houses and all they're talking about is Breaking Bad. You know, so people are fascinated, and that is our communal culture. It's central to the culture. They talk about that in the way that we used to talk about, I don't know, Dennis Potter or whatever when we were kids in the 70s. So it's fantastic that storytelling is still so important to people. The novel isn't quite an obscure form, and it may or may not die out, you know. But the idea of telling stories with real characters over a long period of time is still really central and really important.
Any more questions?
I'll take one more question and then I'm going to sign books.
Oh, look at that, two. Go on, take two. Two hands have gone up.
People always say, my question comes in two parts, they always say. At which point your heart just really, really sinks.
Just carrying on from what you were saying about the long form, or long form television, from the long form novel. Novels, it just strikes me that we're a sort of more elite form of a readership and things, whereas television, the long form novel, is much more leveling of the playing field, isn't it? Would you say?
Yeah, it's really central. I mean, it's really posh people and really, you know, non posh people who are watching it and talk about it all the time. Yeah, and you can read really I was reading a really complex Lacanian analysis of True Detective the other day. I hadn't seen True Detective, but I was really interested in the analysis of it. Made me really want to look at it. So, yeah, it's interesting how different forms, you know, the long-form telly is as important as the cinema was to us, or pop was to us when we were kids. You know.
That same guy, the guy who did True Detective, there was an interview with him in, I think it was the Sunday Times, and I'm not sure if it's Brian Appleyard, and he was picking up on some of the things that you were actually saying about what is it we can say, because he was being taken apart by the fact that there are almost no women in it, or the women in it who are portrayed as hookers or whores or any number of other things. I haven't seen it because I don't get Sky. But it was, I'm fascinated by just actually what you're saying and just wrapping it up, that actually it is all about language, isn't it?
Well, you're right about that. I mean, all the comedies have got women in them, and all the long-term serious ones are about men. Sopranos, Breaking Bad, and so on. There are not enough evil women, but Claire in House of Cards, played by Robin Wright, is fantastic in that part. But you're right, go and write one. Okay.
Right, I'm just going to, before I allow him to go and write, sign the books, I just want to leave you with a quote from the book, because it kind of sums up what we've been talking about and much of what Hanif has been saying. He'd been a writer, a maker of worlds, a teller of important truths. This was a way of changing things, of living well and creating freedom. Hanif Qureshi, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rosie.